Shrink Wrap Radio number 479, How to Get the Most Out of Psychotherapy, with Jungian analyst Gary Trosclair.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today, my guest is Jungian analyst Gary Trosclair, who has written the 2015 book, I'm Working on It in Therapy, How to Get the Most Out of Psychotherapy. For more information about Gary Trosclair, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. One of today's sponsors is Audible.com, who has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken audio products. Get a free audiobook of your choice at www.audibletrial.com/shrink. And before we go to the interview, I want to let all you professionals know that our strategic partner, the Jung Platform, has created CE courses from selected Shrink Wrap Radio interviews on topics such as dreams, relationships, synchronicity, trauma, and more. Go to www.jungplatform.com to see the latest courses. Now, here's today's interview. Dr. Gary Trosclair, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on, Dave.
Well, it's good to have you here. Actually, I am under the impression that you are at least an occasional listener. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Well, great.
I'm them on the train.
Listen on the train. Okay. I was fascinated to learn in your bio that you were a concert musician and actually have a PhD in music before going on to become first a social worker and then a Jungian analyst. What can you tell us about that journey from music to becoming an analyst?
Well, some people actually say that being a musician is one of the best trainings there is to becoming an analyst, because you need to be attuned to emotions, you need to be able to get along with people, need to listen well. So it's actually a very good training. There's a sort of sensitivity involved. But I had also been fascinated from psychology from the time I was 14 years old. I didn't feel I could really understand religion without understanding psychology, but I was so in love with music that I pursued that for many years. And then I went to Europe, and I was playing in an orchestra there, and I brought like a stack of 10 Jungian books with me to read. And while I was there, I decided that becoming a Jungian analyst was going to be much more interesting than being a trumpet player. That's how I came to do that, to make that change.
Well, that's a really interesting story. And now you've written a book that I think is a wonderful book about how therapy clients can get the most out of psychotherapy. What inspired you to write a book about the client's role in psychotherapy?
Well, there's so many things. I'll start off with the anecdotal. I was asked to write for Huffington Post many years ago, and the idea was to have a Jungian analyst write for Huffington Post. But I soon realized that what people really needed there was to start to understand how the process of therapy works, because my experience is that many people really were kind of lost with it. I love to talk to my friends who are in therapy or have been in therapy and say, what was it like? What did you get out of it? And I started to ask them, did you have any idea what you actually were supposed to do in therapy? And most of them said, I had no idea. Some of them were even resentful about the fact that they didn't get more guidance from their therapist about it. So I started thinking more and more about how this is something that's been left out. Of what the patient's role is in psychotherapy. So as I got curious, I started to read about the research about it. And I came across a researcher named Arthur Bohart from California State University.
Oh, yes, I've met him. Yeah.
He's written a book about how patients make therapy work. And he's accumulated tons of research that's showing that what it really comes down to is the patient's active engagement in therapy that determines how effective the therapy is. But if you start to look close at the research that's there, it's not very specific about what clients actually need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote to a very prominent contemporary researcher now named Paul Krit Christoff, and I said, what does research, psychological research, have to offer the client that would like to know what he needs to do to make psychotherapy work? He says, you know, no one's ever looked at it from that angle, so far as I know. So I think it's something that's been neglected. If you look at some other current researchers now, including Jacques Barber, Robert Summers, they talk about the importance of including education, transparency, and elucidation in therapy. They're developing a new model that they call pragmatic psychodynamic psychotherapy, in which they talk about this importance of educating people. It used to be around, but for some reason, the last couple of decades, it's been, I think, neglected. If you read Lester Laborsky's book on psychodynamic psychotherapy, he gives a whole appendix on how to give a talk at the beginning of a consultation. Now, personally, when I read that talk, I can't imagine doing that. There's far too many words that people won't be able to take in.
Yeah.
There is a role for educating clients about what their role is. I think in the past, sometimes it's been seen as resistant if people aren't, quote, cooperating. Hans Strups did some research, again, a few decades ago. He was noticing that many people who come from socioeconomic backgrounds, low socioeconomic backgrounds, didn't stay in therapy very long. They had a high early dropout rate. So he thought about it, and they devised a film that people could watch before they started psychotherapy, and their retention rates went way up. The efficacy rate went way up, too. But I think this is something that's gotten lost in the last couple of decades.
Well, it seems like just a really good idea. When I saw your book, the title, and started reading the book, I thought, boy, this makes so much sense. And, you know, I wondered, well, why hasn't this been done before? Or at least, you know, I wasn't terribly aware of it having been done before. Certainly not as clearly as you've laid it out. And what came to my mind is that one obstacle might have been the profusion of different schools of therapy. So it'd be hard for a given therapist to sit down and write a general document that could cover, you know, all the possibilities. Now, it seems like part of the way that you dealt with that is to say, okay, I'm talking about psychodynamic psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a good way to deal with that challenge, I guess. Although, you know, I think what you say maybe might also apply to other approaches as well. Having used the term psychodynamic, though, maybe not all, although it's come up a lot in my interviews, but maybe not all my listeners will be on board. What do you mean by psychodynamic psychotherapy?
By psychodynamic, I mean a therapy which engages the unconscious in a dynamic way. It understands that's movement in the unconscious. And along with that, an importance of the therapeutic relationship. So those are two fundamental importances of psychodynamic. It's an unconscious that's alive, that's changing, that we can work with. And that we do that through the therapeutic relationship. Now, what I've been hearing from some people who've heard other interviews or discussions from a CBT, that is a cognitive behavioral perspective, say that, well, most of the tools, the 10 tools that I mentioned in my book, actually work quite well along with CBT. I think some of the ones that I emphasize, such as developing a deep, authentic relationship with your therapist, might not apply always in CBT. But most of these tools, I think, are actually quite parallel to CBT. What I'm interested in are the common factors in therapy. You know, while I'm trained as a Jungian analyst, I've also had supervision and analysis with an interpersonalist. And to me, I'm always learning from other schools. And I think other schools are starting to discover Jungian ways of thinking about things. And certainly Jungians are drawing from other schools. So I think it serves us all and our clients quite well to draw and learn from each other and say, what are the common elements that work across the board here?
Yeah.
Let's get into the franchise thing. Let's say, what is working across the board and try to use those more.
Right. And I think also maybe it's a bit easier because I think to some extent the sharp delineations between schools of psychotherapy really is beginning to blur, and that's kind of what you're getting at.
Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah, which is a good thing. I think it was in the early days, it was pretty fragmented and people planting their flag, you know, and saying, this is the approach that I have invented and this is the gospel.
Yeah, it is like a franchise. You know, you spend your time developing it and you want to support it. But I don't think that's in the interest of everyone involved.
You know, they used to say that the clients who didn't do well in psychotherapy were not psychologically minded, mm-hmm. and you refer to people from lower social economic strata, and I think often that was the case for that group, and there were times when I felt that was just an excuse when therapy didn't work, didn't go well. Oh well, the patient just wasn't psychologically minded. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I think one of the positive things that happened in psychoanalytic and psychodynamic therapy over the last few decades is we've tried to open up the gates to include more and more people, to help more and more people, rather than set this barrier and say, well, this person's analyzable, that person's not analyzable. My interest is, to be honest, much more in helping people than in, quote, doing psychoanalysis. You
mm-hmm.
know?
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, maybe we could look at your book as a tool for creating psychologically minded clients. Does that make sense?
That's my hope. That is what it's for. Because one of the things that I hope to do whenever I work with someone is to give them tools that they can take with them when they leave.
Mm-hmm.
It's conceivable to help someone in psychotherapy, and they make some progress. But if those tools aren't quite conscious to them when they leave, they may not benefit as well. And so if I can make those tools very conscious to them during the treatment to highlight them, I feel like I'll be sending them off with much more resource to work with once they finish.
Yeah, and that attitude really comes through in your writing. And now, as you've alluded, your book is organized around 10 major ideas or tools. And without giving everything away, I mean, we want people to buy your book, but I'd like to step you through those 10 ideas or tools here. Is that
sure.
okay?
Sure.
So the first one is that clients need to get real, to take off their mask and show their many faces. And I guess many times they might come to therapy because of a bothersome symptom or other difficulty in their life, and it might not occur to them that revealing their whole self is necessary. Do you agree?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think what you're referring to is sort of a symptom-based approach as opposed to a holistic and personality-based approach. And what's often not clear to people when they first come to therapy is that symptom that they have, there's probably a lot going on there that doesn't meet the eye. And to try to just take that one symptom away might not work very well for them. Whereas if we look at the whole personality and try to include all the different parts of the personality, we're much more likely to get to the root of it. And that is my interest. I know that there are some approaches which are mainly about having evidence that you can remove a particular symptom. That doesn't interest me so much. I'm interested in helping people develop their entire personalities. And my experience is that as you do that, the symptoms do tend to diminish or go away.
Yeah.
I think...
What other sorts of things might get in the way of their taking off their masks and revealing their many faces, as you put it?
I think some of it might be a conception about how therapy works. I think some people might imagine that if they're going to be a really good client and they're going to do everything that the psychotherapist says and they're going to be very compliant and they're going to be a good patient. And as someone once said, save me from a psychoanalysis that goes smoothly, you know, If it all goes smoothly and perfectly, then we're missing a lot of the really juicy stuff. On the other hand, some might come into therapy thinking that the way to work on it is to be very distant, very analytical, very intellectual, and you're going to miss a lot of the juicy stuff there too. So what I'm encouraging is to bring the part of their personality that they most often want to leave out.
Yeah.
I give an example in the book of a woman who came for a consultation who's a very strong woman, very determined, very hardworking and ambitious, but she found herself crying in the session. And that was the part that she wanted to leave out. But thank goodness for her, she was able to bring that in because in order to be able to learn from those tears and from that part of her was immensely helpful in her growth.
I'm glad you brought in an example, and please feel free to add any others as we go along. What about a person maybe who's has a shameful secret they feel that they don't want to share? They don't want to, you know, that's the thing they're most scared of. Is, am I going to have to talk about X? I don't feel like X is at all involved in what's going on with me now.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, and I know this is scary for some people. What I recommend is that you shouldn't feel that you have to share it right away. That it might take time to build up some trust with the therapist, and some understanding of how it might be connected. But what I do suggest with people is to be able to say, look, I'm not really ready to share everything with you yet. And that's straightforward. It's authentic. And just that in itself could be a great step. But I think it's understandable that people need to take time to reveal certain things.
Yeah. Oh, I like your response very much. And it's interesting that that is, in fact, meeting the mandate to say I'm not ready to talk about that. That's revealing something right there.
Yeah,
and taking a risk to share something. The next tool you call channel the flow of feeling, which you describe as having your feelings without your feelings having you. That almost sounds like Buddhist mindfulness to me. Tell us what you're getting at there.
There are a lot of parallels here. I mean, I love to meditate myself, though I'm not a meditation teacher. I think there's much to be learned from Buddhist psychology. Mm-hmm. The idea is to be able to honor and respect feelings without it running over us. Here again, I think some of the common misconceptions about how to work on it in therapy are that we come in and we just express our feelings and we just kind of let it out and we get rid of it and we vent. That's part of it. On the other hand, other people just want to be intellectual about it and try to distance themselves from the feelings. Neither one of these really value feelings. The idea is to let a feeling rise up into consciousness, to hold it and contain it, and to see what we have to learn from it, to see what it tells us about how to live or about what's being left out. And I actually try to encourage people to imagine it rising up from within their belly, to hold it in their head, not to try to get rid of it, not to try to avoid it, but also not to react to it. Because reacting to a feeling is, in a way, just another way of trying to get away from it.
Mm-hmm. The next tool you've described as enough about them. What? You mean my problems aren't all about what somebody else did to me?
Yes. Your problems might be caused by what people did to you in the first place, but the best way we can help you is to help you to find resources within. I think most people kind of know this on an intuitive level, that if they just complain about other people, they'll be wasting their time. I think it's very important to come in and talk about how you've been hurt or disappointed or saddened or infuriated by people around you. It's a great way to start a session. But if we continue a session that way, we're losing out on a lot. Because what I want to do is empower people rather than make them a victim of what they've been through. Now, I do want to acknowledge the reality of trauma, neglect, pain and suffering, but if we leave people there, I don't think that we're helping them any. At the same time, I would emphasize how deep the resources that we have are inside. This is not just about not focusing on someone else, it's also looking at what do our emotions have to offer us, what do our dreams, what does our imagination have to offer us. So, for instance, if we're talking a lot about another person, if we can slow down and say, wait, why does this person push my buttons? What is it about them that's getting to me? Then I can take that and find out, where does that exist in myself? The technical term for this is projection. That we all have a tendency, in some cases, to take something inside of us that we don't like about ourselves and to put it into another person. We call that projection. To have them carry the dirty stuff or the shadow stuff for us. When you find yourself getting really exercised about somebody else or really bothered by them, that's a great opportunity to say, why does that bug me so much? And to see if there's some way that either you do that yourself and you don't acknowledge it, or you don't allow yourself to do it at all and you resent not being able to do it. Now, these are somewhat subtle psychodynamic processes. But if you slow down, and with the help of your therapist, you can start to take back things that actually empower you than leaving you subject to other people's whims.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like the way you put that. Now, the next tool or attitude that you recommend is not to hold back, but to forge an authentic connection with your therapist. And you mentioned authenticity earlier. This sounds a lot like the first one about taking off one's masks. What's the additional mojo that you're getting at here?
It's much more specific about your relationship with the therapist. And I've been often surprised when people would come into therapy with me after being with other therapists for years and not realize that was actually very important for them to tell me their reactions to me. I think in some cases it's a cultural issue, like you never would critique or complain to your doctor, depending upon which culture you're in. But I think even with mainstream American culture, the idea that you can talk about what you're really feeling with your therapist is a new idea for many people, and it can be a scary idea for many people. But this might be one of the most profound parts of psychodynamic therapy that helps us to change. It's very real. It's no longer theoretical about what you're doing with someone outside of the room. It's something that really is going on in the moment, and that's the kind of thing that actually changes us.
Okay.
So it's an opportunity to practice the things from the first session. Yes, to take off the mask, to have the feelings. For instance, that really hurt me when you said that last week. Or I'm very disappointed that you're not talking about certain things. Or I feel like you don't care about me. Or I feel like you care about me too much. To be able to talk about any of these things makes it... It takes it to a deeper level that actually changes the wiring in our brain. You know, we've got a lot of neuro research going on that talks about how important the therapeutic relationship is. But I think some people imagine that you just come in and it just happens naturally. Well, in some cases it does, but sometimes it's really important for us to be able to open up directly with our therapist to be able to bring that there.
Yeah, you know, that makes me think of another rule that maybe it's buried in here and implicit, but the need for the client to be active.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, to be honest, I think some of the theory and some of the things about psychotherapy that are reaching the mainstream public these days can be misleading. Alan Francis, who was instrumental in DSM-3 and DSM-4 and eminent professor from Duke University, had a piece on Huffington Post maybe 5 or 6 weeks ago when he talked about the magical healing properties of the therapeutic relationship. On the one hand, I think that's true. On the other hand, it can apply to people that if you just go in, your therapist empathy and the healing will completely do it all. And I don't think we do people service when we imply that that's all they need to do. So the client really does need to take an active role to get the most that they can out of psychotherapy. And I also want to be clear about this. I think many people go into therapy to simply sustain themselves in a very difficult time. That's very understandable. Those people may not be using all the tools in this book. There's no judgment about that. The tool is intended to help people get the most out of therapy, which does require some active work on the part of the client.
Yeah.
It's a responsibility to start to explain that better than I think we have.
And I like the way that you use ordinary language to talk about these various elements. For example, rather than talking about transference, which is a technical term, you're talking about authenticity and the relationship and so on. And that's something that I really like about what your approach is here. Your next instruction is to be curious rather than judgmental. And again, this reminds me very much of mindfulness practice. What's your spin on this?
Yeah, it is very close to mindfulness because when people are practicing mindfulness meditation, they're trying to sit with what is without judgment about it, to just be with it is, and to be very curious about it. I have cartoons throughout the book for each chapter and for the appendices. And one of my favorite cartoons in there is a car parked on the street, and a man has a baseball bat, and he's just destroying this car. It's just completely beat up. And this woman walks by and says, "It still won't start?" If you're beating up on yourself, it's not going to help you to get moving.
Ah, yes.
So attack is not going to help in psychotherapy. And I make it very clear to people that this is one of their jobs in therapy, is not to self-attack. It might seem obvious, but it's remarkably difficult, I think, for the large majority of people who come to therapy, not to self-attack, but to say, okay, this is where I am now. That doesn't mean that I can't change. But this is the place to start, and it's really the only place to start.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we want to be very curious and to be honest with ourselves about what our motivations are. Why are we doing the things we're doing? Where does it come from? What do we get out of it? I've got a piece coming out, it actually just came out on Huffington Post today about self-deception and why self-awareness matters. We all use rationalization or self-deception to some extent, and I think we want to be very forgiving, understanding about it, but also curious. Why do I need to deceive myself about this? Because it causes us and the communities around us great suffering.
Mm-hmm. The next thing that you advocate is to carry your fair share. What are you getting at there? And maybe you can give us an example of a client not carrying their fair share.
Okay. Well, I'm referring to responsibility, or to carry our fear of responsibility. Because if we don't take responsibility for what we do and don't do, we won't get very far in therapy. On the other hand, if we take too much responsibility and we blame ourselves for the entire thing, then we're not going to make much progress either. I think a typical example of someone who takes too much responsibility is someone who's a child, their parent had some deficit. The parent wasn't able to be fully present to them, wasn't able to help them as much as they needed. Children will often take responsibility for that problem and say, it's me. The problem is me. There's something wrong with me. I'm not lovable. Because if they don't do that, then they're really up a creek because it feels like it's out of their control. Now, on the other hand, if someone comes in and they're only talking about what's wrong with their spouse and not looking at how they treat their spouse, that affects why their spouse is responding to them the way they are, that's not going to help them get where they want either, because that also leaves them feeling very powerless in the long run. There's a certain, one might feel strong and one might feel righteous, justified in it, but it doesn't get you very far.
So there's a kind of balance that the person needs to find between blaming others, sort of taking no responsibility on the one hand, and taking too much responsibility on the other.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
I remember a client asked me one time, she said, well, am I responsible for my depression? And it's a really interesting question, you know, if you think about the biological aspect of it plus the environmental aspect of it. And, you know, I've thought about this a lot, and I think there are some things that we can take immediate responsibility for. You know, like, don't throw the tomato soup at the other person. That's a very concrete action that you can start taking responsibility for. On the other hand, if you've got bipolar disorder, that's not something you can just snap out of. And with work and medication over time, you can take more responsibility. Mm-hmm. There's tons of stuff in the middle that with our intention, with our work in psychotherapy, and with responsibility, that with time we can have more responsibility for it.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. We so much want to have a simplified world and try to kind of make it either or, but as you indicate, it's not always that simple, and there are gray areas, and we do have to find that place of balance. The seventh tool you've labeled as What's Your Story? And what are you calling for there?
Many people come into therapy and their tendency is to talk about this incident and that incident and then the incident 2 weeks ago and the incident yesterday, connecting the dots of those incidents. So the idea is to find the theme of the different incidents and to understand the story behind those incidents. There's a lot of interesting work that's been done in narrative about finding what is the basic story that we tell ourselves about our lives. Now, that could be a long, epic story, or it could be a simple attachment idea, which is something to the effect of, if I get close to someone, they will abandon me. that is a story that can completely dictate someone's lives.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm encouraging people to do is not think just in terms of isolated situations, but to try to understand the themes and to connect the dots on the many incidents in their lives. Or another way to talk about it is to think in terms of one's personality, one's character, rather than the different incidents they go through. And here again, this is something that you can take with you rather than just depending on a therapist to help you deal with each incident that comes up. Now, some of these stories, I talk about being based on attachment. Attachment is one of the theories that's coming out of a lot of developmental theory these days about how we relate to our early caregivers and the way we decide it's best to bond with people. I mentioned one which is, well, there's ambivalent in which we want to be close, but we're afraid of being close. Sometimes people will dismiss anyone rather than getting close to them. Other people have secure attachment in which they feel good about being healthily interdependent. That's a basic story that looks back in our lives about where we came from and how that influences how we live now. But there are also stories that are more archetypal that we find in literature, in mythology, in spirituality, fairy tales, in contemporary films. And these are themes or stories that we've been telling each other for thousands of years that can be very helpful to help us understand the journey of life. On the other hand, we can get caught in them in a destructive way. We can get caught in a victim story, or we can get caught in a hero story. And either of those have good or bad qualities depending on how conscious we are of them.
There's our Jungian coming out now. but again, in a very down-to-earth, relatable way. The next tool seems like an extension of that one, of what's your story, in as much as you've labeled it as it ain't necessarily so. Tell us about that.
You're right. I could have put these in the same chapter together, but it felt more helpful to me to separate it, to make sure that people do take the time to understand their story. And I wanted to really emphasize finding the themes in their life, but then also questioning those themes. Is it really so that if I get close to someone, they will abandon me, for instance?
Mm-hmm.
Is it really so that if I sacrifice myself in some heroic way, that it will work for me? That might also bring me down and help hurt other people too. So once you identify the story, to say, is that story working for me? And is there a story that would work for me that's better than that? Now, you'll probably recognize some CBT techniques in here, which is fine with me. I think psychodynamic therapists were challenging thinking for decades before CBT came around. It's fine. Everybody can use it. That's great. But I do think there are times, especially after we've done all the previous work that I talk about in the early chapters, that when we understand our story, we can begin to challenge it. We can start to say, maybe that's not so true. And I don't think we can always do that right at the beginning. We can't just try to talk ourselves out of something intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of groundwork, then you have an idea of the stories that are running your life. You can start to see when you come to the fork in the road each time, maybe I don't have to live that way. Maybe it's not necessarily so.
Yeah, yeah. Now, your next to last recommendation is to do something. What are some examples of activities that you recommend? I'm impressed by the breadth and the liberalness of your recommendations.
So I go somewhat out of psychoanalytic tradition here.
Yeah.
There are four categories that I speak of here. The first one is just you can do things like exercise and meditation, yoga, very practical things that all support your work in psychotherapy. They might not seem specifically coming out of those issues, but they all do contribute to it. We know, for instance, that exercise improves our cognitive functioning. It improves our emotional life. We know that research says that in some cases it's just as helpful as psychotropic medications. So it goes along with the psychotherapy itself. Then there's another category which I refer to as intentions and assignments. Now, assignments are a very behavioral sort of treatment. I don't use them very often, but occasionally there'll be a therapist for whom it's helpful for us to develop a particular goal that comes out of the dynamic work that we've done. I don't think that that has to be part of therapy. For some people, it can be very helpful. But I think what more often happens is what I refer to as intentions. And by intentions, I mean a conscious decision to say, this is my goal, and I'm going to look to see wherever I can meet it. For instance, someone might decide that they're going to be less impulsive, and there are many different ways to meet that. Someone else might decide that they won't act on their fear as much, and they're going to try to socialize as much. Other people might say, my intention is to not give myself away so much, and I'm going to make sure that I give myself time to do the things I need to do to take care of myself. So those are broad intentions. And again, while that might sound like a cognitive technique, I think that when it comes down to it, a lot of dynamic work actually comes down to using that sort of conscious intention that we hold in mind once we leave the session. Because we do need to apply the things that we're talking about in session, outside of session. And that's what starts to make it more solid, more concrete, in a way that actually stays with us.
Yeah.
Then I talk about creative ways that we can continue our work outside of therapy. This can mean working with your dreams. For instance, Jungians have a technique called active imagination, in which we'll dialogue with a character from a dream. You get yourself into a quiet place where you won't be disturbed, and you bring to mind in as much feeling and sensate detail as you can that particular character or that mood. And you actually have a dialogue with them. For some people, they'll write it down. Other people might dance it. Other people might play the music or to draw a painting of it. But the idea is to take the experience, the inner experience that you begin to work on in therapy, and to continue to work on that outside of your therapy. Jung was very big on this kind of thing. In fact, while Freud was meeting at least 4 or 5 times a week, Jung said, I actually prefer, after you get started, to have just 1 or 2 sessions a week for people to continue the work on their own by painting their dreams, by doing active imagination, by writing out imaginative scenarios, because that helps us to connect with the unconscious and also to affirm the work that we've begun. Because what we want to do once people leave is, again, to send them off with the tools that they can use on their own. The way I see it, a fundamental tool of analysis is to develop a very good working connection with the unconscious, and this is one way to start to do that.
Yeah, that's great.
The last of the 4 broad categories that I use for working outside of therapy has to do with ceremony and ritual. Those things get a very bad name. People say, oh, it's just symbolic, or it's just ceremonial. But I come across some research from some folks at Harvard that said, whether people believe it or not, ritual and ceremony really do change, and they have a huge impact, even when the people don't think it does.
Huh.
Once you decide, for instance, that you want to change your story, to have some sort of ritual that would help you to actually make that change in a concrete behavioral way. For some people, I know one woman who decided to burn all of her journals, and that was the marking of a passage from her from an old life to a new life, old story to new story. On the other hand, someone else might say, you know, being able to reflect is profoundly important to me. My ritual is going to be every morning I'm going to write 3 pages. There are other rituals such as ceremonies. Weddings can be profoundly important. I think they've become kind of a show these days, but they actually do make an important difference for people.
Yeah. This you mentioned that this was stepping outside the bounds of at least traditional psychoanalytic thought, because I can recall a time when those sorts of activities would have been maybe labeled as resistance, as trying to deal with issues outside the relationship instead of bringing it into the therapy.
Yeah, I don't think it has to be an either or. Mm-hmm. I think that work outside can deepen the work, because people realize things about themselves when they're working outside on their own. So I understand the old theory, but I think the other thing to keep in mind is when a lot of our psychoanalytic theory and guidelines were developed, people were coming in 4 or 5 times a week. That's a whole different thing, which is different from the way we're working now, once or twice. In that old model, there might have been things to gain by, say, don't do anything outside of session. But with the model that we have now, once or twice a week, for most of us, you don't get as much from that whole model. And it's worth it to do the outside work. And I think some of the traditional psychoanalytic thought, too, came out of a much different era.
Yes.
Different people 100 years.
Right.
Even CBT therapy now, we've got research that says it's not as effective as it was 30 years ago.
Oh, that's fascinating. That triggers a whole bunch of associations for me. One of the main ones, going back to the early days of mesmerism and then hypnosis, where some of the early people were saying something very similar. You know, we saw things happening in the early days of mesmerism and hypnosis that we don't see anymore. You know, and you have to wonder about that.
There's a whole cultural context, a zeitgeist, which I suspect affects how effective some types of work are.
Yeah, yeah. A related question that this brings up for me is, what are your thoughts about self-help books? And I don't quite see your book as a self-help book. It could be described that way, maybe. But, you know, there are books that are more explicitly of, you know, self-help.
I have no problem with that at all. I think it can add to the work. What I do recommend, though, is if people... Now, are you talking about self-help along with therapy or instead of therapy?
Well, that's a good distinction, I guess. I guess I'll let you talk about both.
Yes. I think it can be a very good addition to psychotherapy. What I do recommend, if people are reading self-help books, to bring that stuff into their therapy and to connect it with what's going on in therapy, especially if what they read in the self-help book seems to be different from what's going on in the therapy, because that's one of those really juicy things about it happening in the present moment with your therapist. And I think people can get stuff out of self-help books on their own. I do make my living this way, but I think it's hard to do this sort of thing on your own. Human beings seem to be hardwired to change through our interactions with other people.
Mm-hmm.
You find that not only in psychology, but in so many spiritual traditions, career things, that we just take in things on a much deeper level when there's another person there that we're doing it with.
Yeah, yeah.
I think depending upon what you accomplish, not sure it's going to be enough.
Mm-hmm. Your final recommendation or tool you characterize as Into the Fire. Tell us about that.
Okay. There is a long-standing tradition, certainly in spiritual approaches, but also within psychology, to take the very difficult thing and make that the fodder, the opportunity for change. Because when you're in the fire, you're much more malleable. Think for a moment about putting a piece of metal into a fire in order to forge a very strong sword. It's when the difficult things are coming up that we're much more open to be able to change. Now, here, too, we've got a burgeoning field of research called post-traumatic growth, in which, rather than seeing people as always being hurt through trauma, they can see how people can actually grow through their trauma. And so I'm building on that, but also looking at so many of the spiritual traditions behind it that say when things are difficult, this is the opportunity for change. One of the presentations that I've been doing takes tons of slides and shows how fire is so often used symbolically in spiritual traditions to help people experience these difficult situations as hot periods when that's the opportunity for change. And so many ceremonies are festivals. So let's take Burning Man now, you know.
Okay.
You know, some Celtic celebrations, I'm forgetting the name of it right now, where people will jump over the fire. Or most spiritual traditions have some use of fire, whether it just be a candle that they're close to or some more open fire.
What about fire walking? That's, you know, that was a kind of a cultural thing for a while here.
It is. It's been found in many different traditions. Sweat lodges.
Oh, yeah.
Swallowing fire. It's kind of like shooting a fish in a barrel with this stuff when you start looking around at pictures of fire. So often it's an opportunity for growth and for internalizing and changing something that we wanted to change. And that's the time when it's most effective to make the change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You said something early on at the very beginning of our talk that you just kind of slid by, making some reference to religion. And I think that it sounds like that's been a strong element in your life from very early on.
It's been helpful to me. Currently, my practice of insight meditation is very important to me. And I think it's I've often learned from it about how we function psychologically. It's been a source of information. But as a Jungian analyst, what I've also found, though, that many people who come to see me don't necessarily have a spiritual approach. And I can try to force them into it and say they should have experience of something greater than themselves. But I'm interested in being able to meet people where they are and to find a way to have a relationship of something greater than they are, which is not spiritual in the traditional or religious sense. Because I think that as Jungians, we've often preached to the choir that it's somewhat easy to attract people to Jungian analysis who are already interested in mythology or spirituality.
Yes.
But there are many people who could benefit from Jungian analysis who that doesn't resonate so much for.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like part of my job, my goal as a Jungian analyst, is to be able to meet people where they are. And that might not involve a spiritual perspective. Now, how you define a spiritual perspective is a whole different question. But if, for instance, I can help someone to have a sense of what I refer to in the book as the constructive unconscious, that is, in addition to their ego, there's a whole part of their personality, the unconscious, that if they collaborate with, if they work with, if they listen to, it will not only help remove symptoms, but it will help them have a much greater sense of wholeness. Because that's part of what I'm aiming for in my work with people, is to have a sense of wholeness rather than limited just to a small ego which gets buffeted about by the winds of change.
Yeah, yeah. Now, this might seem like too obvious to deserve asking, but who should read this book?
Okay. I have heard from many people that it's a great introduction for people who are just starting therapy, for people who are also curious about therapy, because therapy is so poorly known, it's so poorly described in popular media, that I believe it gives people a real honest sense of what happens in therapy, what it's actually like. I have appendices both on starting therapy and stopping therapy to help people give an idea about how you start, but also to know when to stop. So I think it's good for people who are just considering therapy, people who are, but also people already in it. But I also hope that therapists and even researchers will read it for a couple of reasons. Therapists tend to have a tendency, to take far too much responsibility for the work. And I think especially in the last few decades, when we talk about the importance of attunement and empathy and resonating with our patients, those are profoundly important. But it can leave out the fact that patients do they need to take an active role in the work, or else they won't get as much out of it. What I hope is that therapists will also read it, and they can develop their own sense of what clients need to do, because it's important for you to have your sense of what patients need to do. Don't necessarily take my word for it. But I hope to provoke thought about this, to provoke discussion. And I'm even hoping that some researchers will read it and say, wait, you know, there's something we've been missing here. Maybe there's a way for us to research it and to be more specific about what the client needs to do, because we've been focusing almost exclusively for decades now on what the therapist needs to do. And to me, that's not only just leaving something out, it misses a whole respect aspect of therapy, in which it implies that it's what the therapist does rather than what the client does. And it really is a lot about what the client does. And I mean that in a very respectful way, not in a blaming way. When people have done work, they have done a lot of work, you know. And I think we want to give credit for that. In a way, the big picture for this to me, too, is a philosophy. I want to get away from the idea of doing a procedure on someone, or to someone, rather than I want to be doing it with someone. That it's a dialectical procedure where we're both engaged, so that it affirms their sense of self rather than one that leaves them dependent on me.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I'm impressed with about you is the way that you integrate and the effort and energy that you put into integrating research and practice. You know, that's something that we're urged to do, but I don't know how many clinicians really do that.
Yeah. Well, I think some people probably say it's one of my complexes that I have a need to know. You know, why ignore all the research? My take on it is that if you take one or two individual studies, you can't depend on them too much. Now, we had this study come out, 6 weeks ago that said that a lot of psychological research, maybe, what is it, 40%, 60%, cannot be replicated. But if you look at the overall picture, if we've got 30 studies talking about the importance of the therapeutic relationship, we can listen to that. We can learn from it. I think psychotherapy research is still pretty young, but I'd rather encourage it and learn what I can from it than to dismiss or ignore it. I think there is a lot to be learned there.
Okay.
As therapists, of just going on anecdotal stuff, the stuff we've been taught by our therapist, by our analyst, and I'd like to have a bigger, more certain picture.
Okay, well, as we wind down here, I wonder if there's anything else that you'd like to add.
Well, I guess the one part that I didn't talk about much, but I alluded to, was this idea of the constructive unconscious. That is that we have within us a deep tendency, a desire, an instinctual need to grow towards wholeness, to become more integrated so that all the different parts of the personality that I started to mention in that first chapter, that they're all working together. I have a couple mandalas in my book, and what a mandala shows is how all these different parts are balanced in harmony, and that even looked at from an evolutionary perspective, that part of us wants to be more flexible, more adaptive, and we do that by listening inside and bringing all the different parts together. And if we have that attitude of listening within, then that changes the whole picture. So rather than our problems being crises, they're opportunities that something inside is often trying to tell us, or that we're going to make something out of it.
Well, that's a good wrap-up. Dr. Gary Trosclair, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. I've enjoyed our discussion.
One of the things that really stands out for me about Dr. Trosclair's book is his very down-to-earth, non-technical writing. A lot of writing by Jungians can make for very challenging reading. This is not only due to an abundance of technical terms, but also to high levels of abstraction, along with the assumption that the reader has an insider's knowledge of the field and frequent references to mythology, literature, or other domains with which the reader may not have any familiarity. By contrast, Gary's book is written in plain English that anyone could read and benefit from. Although we focused on the benefits of his book for therapy clients, I think there are psychotherapists out there who would find it useful as well. I recall as a young therapist that sometimes therapy would drag and I'd have a floundering feeling of being lost. I think the tools that Gary calls attention to could also be good reminders for therapists during such lulls to help kickstart their motors and get them re-energized and reoriented as to what to focus on. Beyond this, I think therapists should have several copies of this book to loan out to new clients. It will save time and ensure that they're on the same page, so to speak. And even though Gary is rooted in the Jungian tradition, There are very few things in the book to tip one off to that. Consequently, I think his book will be useful to therapists and clients regardless of the therapeutic approach. Finally, I really appreciate his receptivity to cultural changes and his flexibility in terms of willingness to have his clients explore alternative channels of help. The title of Dr. Trosclair's book again is I'm Working on It in Therapy, How to Get the Most Out of Psychotherapy. And as always, if you'll use our Amazon.com affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com, you'll be helping to support shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, Dr. Dave. It's me, Dr. Ahmed Al-Akouri, a psychiatrist from Alexandria, Egypt. I'm a follower for your blog and radio for more than 5 years. I like the episodes, whose content is sometimes practical, pragmatic, and down-to-earth, and sometimes is philosophical and theoretical. I like both approaches. I like your guests, all mental health professionals. Also, I like your disciplined way and speaking style. Your insights regards the union approach got me interested in it. I call my colleagues in mental health profession all around the world to support the Shrink Wrap Radio by donations so it can continue and get more developed and effective. Thank you, Dr. Dev.
Thank you, Ahmed. How wonderful to hear from you, another professional there in Egypt. I didn't know I had any listeners in Egypt, and here you've been listening for a number of years. Thanks so much for encouraging others to follow your fine example. And we do have one new donor on our honor roll, and that's Francis Lynch. Francis, this vote of confidence comes at such a good time. For the past week and a half, I was in crisis mode with our website not showing up properly in the Chrome browser. Clearly, the issue did entail additional expense. Our affiliate sponsor, Sucuri, helped us to work through to a solution. If you have a website, then you really need the kind of protection and troubleshooting they offer. They are the industry leader in security options for websites and blogs. I use them, and you should too. And as an affiliate, we will get a small portion of whatever you spend there. Just go to the Sucuri banner ad in the left-hand sidebar on our site. Click on it, and that will take you to them. And once again, let me mention Dr. Hedaya, whose herbal pain relief product, Unflame, that I've been advertising in our right-hand sidebar, you can get $5 off by using my discount code of UNFL1815 when you call direct at 619-500-HERB, H-E-R-B. I have to figure out what the numbers are so I can just give the numbers. Once again, let me remind you about my CE courses that are offered through the Zur Institute. I have over 100 units there, and you can get them at a 10% discount by using my discount code of DrDave88. And Dr. Dave is just D-R-D-A-V-E and the numerals 88. But wait, there's more. Not only can you get a discount on my courses, but also any of their other 170 courses and private practice materials. Just go to zurinstitute.com and explore their very voluminous site and use my discount code of DrDave88. And by the way, all their courses and materials are approved by the American Psychological Association. Finally, for any of you who are not already members of Audible.com, my favorite audiobook service, I have a great recommendation today. In fact, it's the very book we've been discussing in today's interview. There's an unabridged audio version of I'm Working in It in Therapy, How to Get the Most Out of Psychotherapy by Gary Trosclair. Now, it's not narrated by him. It's narrated by someone by the name of Chris Kaiser, but he does a great job. And it is 7 hours and 39 minutes in length. Let me play you a little sample.
So what am I supposed to do? What do I have to do to change? It was shortly after I'd finished my postgraduate training when Edward, a sturdy young account manager sitting across from me in my office, asked these questions. He'd come to therapy to address his reactive anger and what he recognized as an otherwise shut down emotional life. I told my friends I'm working on it in therapy, but to be honest, I have no bloody idea what that really means. This was his third month in therapy, and we were beginning to gain insight into some of his issues. He was eager to make progress and was willing to work, but he was at a loss as to what he needed to do to make therapy effective. I had to sit back and reflect. It seemed like it should be an easy question, one that I should be able to answer immediately. But the training and study I had done hadn't focused on what the client needed to do. We had focused only on our role as therapists. Thinking on the fly, I told him that his job was to bring himself, each and every part of himself, into our meetings as completely as possible, to tell me about every little scrap of joy or frustration or vulnerability or any other feeling that flashed across his screen before it got deleted by his sensors. But I also wanted him to contain these feelings, not to react to them, so that we could get to know them first.
So that gives you a little sample. Clearly, the audio quality is not as good as it will be when you order this book from audible.com. So if you're not already an audible.com subscriber, you can get this audiobook for free and to keep with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And of course, if that's not to your taste, they now have 180,000 other titles for you to choose from.
Hi, this is author and professor Louis Cozzolino, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Lou Cozzolino, who in fact will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. I'll read two of our recent emails from our listener community today. First, we hear from Charles, who writes, Dr. Dave, I've emailed before and still want to thank you for the amazing info I get each week listening and often listening again to the show. I do appreciate it. I also made a small contribution to the show recently. I'm writing to let you know that the listenership is growing. I'm a professor in the Master in Social Work program at St. Louis University, and a group of my students recently told me they have been listening to Shrink Wrap each week and listening to the previous episodes throughout the week after my references to the show in class. Just wanted to let you know we're all trying to spread the word. Thank you for all that you do. And that's from Charles Frankie. Well, Charles, thanks for your support and for helping to spread the word there in the social work program at St. Louis University. Sounds like a good place. Next, we hear from Lois, who in part writes in response to my thanking her for her donation. And she writes, Hi, David. Thanks for your very appreciative email. I'm happy to tell you that I just get so much learning from your programs and am introduced to new ideas that I find very stimulating. I've listened to loads, but perhaps it was episode number 444 with Maladoma Somme that really prompted me to donate. I loved what he had to say about the wound of being separated from home. As you will know, Europe is in crisis with the refugees pouring out of Syria, and sometimes there is a lack of understanding of what people go through when they are forced to leave their homes. So thanks again, and keep up the good work. And that's from Lois. And Lois, thank you for your support and for your very thoughtful email. I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our app or on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Gary Trosclair, for his insights on how clients can get the most out of psychotherapy. Synchronistically, my next interview will be a perfect follow-on because I'll be speaking with return guest, Dr. Lou Cozzolino, about his latest book, Why Therapy Works, Using Our Minds to Change Our Brains. So I hope you'll join us, and until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, It's all in your mind.
That's right. Shrink Wrap Radio. Coming at you now. Yo, everybody, let's get down. There's a new MC in town. Talking psychology interviews. Dr. Dave is all the rave. Ain't no slouch on the digital couch. He's on the pod. Podcast got the bod. Yeah. You wanna be in the know? No. Talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. I'm talking Shrink Wrap Radio. Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. All right.
You've been shrink wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.